man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 100th episode of Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ify Wadiway, and today we are joined by film reviews editor at The Wrap, Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what's good with you?
Well, you know, I was going to say the champagne that we're using to celebrate the 100th episode, but nobody bought any, so thanks, Max Fun.
I tried to bring cupcakes, but there was a small child who was ordering too many things, and I had to get here.
Oh.
I was standing in line and getting really frustrated.
They ruin everything.
That sounds like an Adult Swim video.
What's good with me is charcuterie.
Ooh.
Because, again, I'm all about the what can we have for dinner that doesn't involve turning the oven on because it's freaking hot outside. And, you know, a night you can build an entire dinner out of like, and it doesn't, you don't have to like go crazy fancy with this. Find a salami you like. Find a cheese you like. Let them both sit on the counter and get like sweaty in room temperature so that, you know, it's easy to cut up and they're more delicious. You know, throw them on a cracker. Maybe get a nice loaf of French bread again with some butter that's, you know, been sitting on the counter in a glass thing, so it's like it flies on it. April's giving me a look like I'm leaving food to rot. No, it's covered. It's a thing, but
rot
it's just
all your best food and put it on a board.
Room temperature. Anyway, and I'm just it's a summer pick me up, and it's a good way to go.
Ooh. It's a picnic in your house.
Yes.
Yeah. Snacky.
With
snacky.
No ants, ideally.
Yes.
And we are also joined by producer and film festival programmer, Drea Clark. Drea, what's good?
What's good is I'm about to get the hell out of Dodge for a minute.
Ooh.
I'm flying back to Minnesconsin tomorrow. I'll be there by the time this is out. I can't wait for the clean air and hearty accents and all the vowels you can eat. I go home every summer and I rent a cabin in Wisconsin with my college friends, and then I'm going to my best friend's toy store, Lark Toys, and then my family's meeting at a lake in northern Minnesota. But what's doubly good, I know.
You have a friend who's got a toy store. Like, you're going into romantic comedy.
No, it's ridiculous. It's really, I'm definitely going to be seated next to a prince on the plane.
Yeah, you're basically doing the wine country thing,
for
right?
For sure. Oh, it's big time going to be that. But what's doubly excited about all of it, the group that I rent the cabin with, one of them, Damien, a.k.a. Davey, sent all of us. Have you guys heard of Cameo?
So you can hire
celebrities or celebrities, quote unquote, to like leave messages or whatever. And so he got one from Andy Dick with like, because our friend group, of course, has a name. We call ourselves the Ribboneers. So it's Andy Dick sent a video to the Ribboneers about our summer vacation. And he started talking about nostalgia. It was actually very sweet. But that's what's good for me is my planned vacation and my personal message from Mr. Andy Dick.
Fun fact, I have a Cameo, so listeners, if you want to say, yeah, what I just, because they like emailed me and I have a hard time saying no to anything, so they're like, join the squad, and I was like, okay, and I signed up. I was like, no one's gonna bother me. Then like a month ago, someone's like, hey, my boyfriend really likes your videos online, can you wish him a happy birthday? And I was like, sure. I would have done it for free.
Do you set your own rate, Ify, or does Cameo tell you what you're worth?
Well, it was like do 15. I was like, okay, so it's like actually it's $20 and they take 5 off the top. Cameo really just takes a chunk when you really think of 15. That's like
25%.
That's a lot.
That's math.
Yeah. I know. I probably broke like an NDA. Who cares? Take me down if you want, Cameo. Power to the people. And for the very last time, we're joined by screenwriter and host of the Switchblade Sisters podcast, April Wolf. April, what is good?
Hey, I've got two things, if that's okay. I'm going to get through real quick. So my cat died last year.
Oh, no.
That's a sad part. Yeah. New part is I'm getting a new kitten.
Yay!
And I just got a message as we were about to start recording that from the foster who's taking care of her right now. And she says, LOL, I think she might have a modeling gig first, though.
Oh, wow.
So,
you got a fancy cat.
She's like, I think that she's going to book a gig. She's all of like 2 pounds and so adorable and still has like a bunch of singed hair because she was found in a parking lot in the desert. And she's so cute, and I hope that she's a little cat model.
April Wolf, stage mother.
I know, because I can't wait to be a stage mom. And then second is that I finally watched The Terror, and motherfucking God. God, that is such a good show. Every single person has been telling me to watch The Terror.
Wait, is it the one with the like
the
ghost
Japanese
bear?
Internment camp?
Yeah.
Thing?
No, not the, because I don't know that that's come out yet. That's in August, I think.
Oh,
it's like
then
the
I
first
don't know The Terror.
This is the original one. This is the first season.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
And it's, gotcha. Yeah, it's like a ghost bear.
Ghost
in
bear
in
the ship.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Polar expedition.
A friend of mine was watching it, and I was like real into snippets, and I was like, I'm going to go back and watch this, but I really don't watch things that are called The Terror or Scary or anything. I'm not going to watch a movie.
Oh,
I'm going to let you know right
Ify.
Now.
Yeah,
he's on my page at this yeah. time.
Ify,
what's
good?
Oh, man. What's good with me? I'm getting ready to go to New York. You know, it's still hot boy summer, so I'm going to, you know, just unbutton the top two buttons at all time. Let the taco meat fly. Outside
God, I
of
hope
that,
you mean your shirt.
Yeah.
He's just got taco meat in it.
I'm not comfortable.
New York in August is just sticky.
Ooh, yeah, I'm not looking forward. But outside of that, I've been hunting down a place for me and my daughter to live, which, you know, as a writer, actor in L.A., you would think most landlords would be used to the fact that we don't have a regular source of income to hand them. But no! It's been lots of arguing and proving myself online. I think I'm getting close. I want to be in Highland Park. I need to be next to Joy. I need to eat as much Joy for the rest of my life. But we'll see. But besides that, on today's show, we'll be discussing the controversial Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And we will receive a phone call from a mystery guest. And as always, we've got staff picks. But first, it's time for our new segment called Itadic, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a new segment and answer the question, is this important? And do I care? And first up, we're talking about Godzilla. The Criterion Collection announced this past week that for its 1,000th entry, it will be releasing an ultimate collection of all 15 Showa-era Godzilla films. It will start with Ichiro Honda's 1954 original Godzilla and go all the way through his final film, 1975 Terra of Mechagodzilla. Some other favorites that will be included in the collection are King Kong vs. Godzilla, Mothra vs. Godzilla, Godzilla vs. Gigan, Godzilla vs. Megalon, and many others. And Criterion promises a landmark set showcasing the technical wizardry, fantastical storytelling, and indomitable international appeal that established the most iconic giant monster that cinema has ever seen. Is this important? Do you care?
Over the course of 100 episodes, I don't know that I've cared more about anything or that it's ever been this important. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I love these movies. And it's funny because there were... I can't remember if it was like when back when Criterion used to be on Hulu or then later when it was on Filmstruck or Canopy, but there were these art images of like a Criterion Godzilla thing for each movie, which for a long time with these rumors, like, well, there could be a box, or they do, are they going to put out a, what's this mean? What's it going to, and this is more than I ever could have hoped for. I am.
Those special features.
Yes. I have such a kaiju boner for this whole project.
Oh,
it's
my.
Insane.
Yeah,
I'm psyched you worked in kaiju. I'm excited for this. I love Godzilla as a franchise. I think it's one of the few international franchises to make such an impact on American audiences, like beyond the idea of cinema, but audiences who watch things. Because, you know, so many people have they have a ingrained hesitance towards anything with subtitles. But you start watching Godzilla, I think we start watching them pretty young. Like a lot of TV shows them and they're enjoyable. And it's one of those things that makes you remember, like, oh, it doesn't have to be, I don't have to feel like I'm learning if I'm watching something with subtitles.
And I think also if you want an example of, like, what bad dubbing looks like, Godzilla movies to kind of bring too, frankly.
But they're, like, there's such a range within those films, but the imagination that comes, like, I obviously am, I don't know why I said obviously. You guys can tell for me, I'm someone who likes
like a really creative person.
I like the physical stuff when I can tell they're stepping on something. But, you know, like they have the ones where they're in the suits. They're the practical effects. They have,
Analog.
I like that. And I like that, the international element of it. That even when, of course, the U.S., what are there, three or four American films now? Five?
Terrible Emmerich one,
that's the P. Diddy one, right?
Yes, and then there was a Godzilla a few years ago, and then this year there was Godzilla King of the Monsters.
So, of course, we wanted to get a part of the train, but even when we did, it remains, it's a Japanese brand. And yeah. I like that because I think we commandeer so many things and kind of suck out the inherent culture and sense of place.
And there's some really great 60s glamour girl, like alien Ooh. Types and mm-hmm. Destroy All Monsters and stuff. And the Mothra Twins.
Yeah, I'm pro-Mothra.
Yeah.
That's a rule.
Yeah.
It's a bold stance.
Yeah. Yeah. Pro-Wolf, pro-Mothra.
Yeah. Here's a positive story.
Oh.
You guys like posi-core stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, or SAG-AFTRA, if you guys are in the business, announced last week that it plans to, quote, create a set of guidelines to try to prevent sexual harassment and exploitation during the filming of nudity or any other kind of hyper-exposed work on film and TV sets. They'll be working with Alicia Rodas, who is the associate director and co-founder of Intimacy Directors International. And according to the press release, quote, the guidelines will seek to establish new relevant policies for nudity and simulated sex, define the duties and standards for intimacy coordinators on productions, and specify acceptable training, vetting, and qualifications of intimacy coordinators. Is this important? Do you care?
I think this is important. I've been on sets where I would have been grateful for an intimacy coordinator. I will say this. When I read through this, it's very, not to get too inside baseball film industry with it, but it very much, it was like when you read about a case that's gone to like the Ninth Court of Appeals and it has no chance to win, but they're doing it, so there's precedence. This to me had shades of it because the idea is they're establishing guidelines that producers can look towards. It's not mandating intimacy coordinators in sex or simulated sex situations, but it's having these. But even having those is something that enables actors to reference and be like, they're right here and this is how they cross that line.
Well, April, you covered this a lot when you yeah. were at LA Weekly. So yeah. is this... At the time that you did the big piece that ran about this, is this the sort of thing they were working toward? Is this like, was this a goal that now they finally met or no?
There was no goal. This was just something that I was talking about because I was concerned about actors who seemed to be very damaged and not very protected on set.
Interesting.
And so this was, you know, a very small thing. There were a few intimacy coordinators who were mostly working in theater because theater and the stage was way ahead of the game and, you know, figuring out what to do with sex and nudity and making sure that people felt protected because, you know, it's a different venue. There's, sure. you know, there's also that case recently. Yeah, I can't remember the actor.
There's a picture of Audra McDonald during Audra Frankie McDonald. And Johnny and the Clear
yeah,
Balloon.
And yeah, it's, and, you know, just trying to have respect for people because they're right there and it's just a different game. And so film and television, way behind the times. This is insane. I think I probably called out SAG-AFTRA and I was just like, oh, I don't know that. Like, I was a little bit obnoxious
about
it. So
now they're coming correct.
I mean, like, that's the thing is, like, all of these actors, I think, are asking for it finally, and they realize that they have rights and that they need to be able to, as Drea says, point to something. Because it is still a kind of, like, actor advocate kind of thing, you know? There aren't going to be guidelines, but the actors need to have the information to say that they can say no to things and that they can ask for specific people on set. And, you know, it's just, it's workplace fucking safety, you guys.
Yeah. Some of you may have heard of The Blacklist, the annual survey of Hollywood executives' favorite unproduced screenplays. They have now partnered with the Latin Tracking Board, Mi Gente, NALIP, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, Remezcla, and Unidos US to create the Latinx List. The intention of this list is to curate a list of promising screenplays written by Latinx writers that, quote, explore the Latinx experience, unquote. According to Marisa Franco of Mi Gente, as Latinx people, we know there are many ways where some of us and parts of all of us are overlooked, excluded, and pushed out of our country's historical, cultural, and artistic narratives. We were eager and honored to participate in building the Latinx List as a way to advocate for our community's stories. Something to consider about this Latinx List is the fact that Latino audiences have the highest movie-going rate in the U.S., but make up only a 5.2% share of all film roles. Is this important? Do you care?
I can't believe that this is something that has not happened earlier.
I know.
When I was working in film development more than a decade ago, we were talking about how Latinx people had the biggest movie-going box office that would bring it, and people were like kind of half-heartedly trying to do these like joint Mexican productions or something, but like nothing ever got off the ground. And now I'm like, you guys should have been fucking doing this, and not just like Mexican, but like Chicano. It should be, you know, Texican. It should be like Americans too, because we often end up getting a lot of like American Latinx people don't get the same opportunities as people who are not in the U.S., which is super weird. It's super weird. I don't know why that is.
You're leaving money on the table, people.
Yeah.
Well, it's the false prestige, and I don't have enough time to truly elaborate
on
this, but it's why a majority of colleges, their black student population is mostly Africans, because there's that kind of model minority attitude towards Africans, and so I think it's kind of the same way, where it's like, oh, these are exotic Latinx people, so we're going to give them opportunities, not like the regular American ones, and that continues to be a problem.
No, I think it's exciting. I think in the last few years, we can really sort of look at a lot of different, cultural groups in Hollywood who are not straight white men, forming these coalitions, forming these sort of programs mm-hmm. to kind of push things forward. I know there was a lot of talk about how the fight to get One Day at a Time renewed at another mm-hmm. network really sort of summoned a kind of Latin voice in the media and culture that hasn't been seen a lot when it comes to sort of pop culture things. So I'm hoping that maybe that's a thing they built on, or that's just a symptom of a thing that's been building all along. But this looks like it's sort of the next manifestation of that. So good for them.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood just as soon as we hear from another one of the shows on the Maximum Fun Network.
Hi, I'm Dave.
Hi, I'm Graham.
And we're two house DJs who have been trapped inside our drum machine.
We love it here, and we'd love if you stopped by and visited us every week on Stop Podcasting Yourself
here on MaximumFun.org.
We're just a couple of doofuses from Canada.
And listen to our show or perish. Stop Podcasting Yourself
on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Who Shot You? I'm your host, Ify Wadiway, and in the studio with me are...
April Wolf.
Drea Clark.
Alonzo Duraldi.
And today, we're talking about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Here's the storyline from IMDb. Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood visits the 1969 Los Angeles, where everything is changing, as TV star Rick Dalton, Leonardo DiCaprio, and his longtime stunt double Cliff Booth, Brad Pitt, make their way around an industry they hardly recognize anymore. The ninth film from the writer-director features a large ensemble cast and multiple storylines in a tribute to the final moments of Hollywood's golden age.
Dun dun!
I guess.
That's it. All right, we're good.
Uh-huh.
We'll say, I think, first thing off the bat, we have to announce first movie without an N-bomb. We made it. We made it. Is this?
Oh, yeah. What a rush.
Well, maybe barely having any black characters might have helped.
Yeah, that 100%.
It doesn't always help.
Yeah. This is true. You're right. Yeah, those it do not go together.
I saw this yesterday afternoon by myself in a matinee, not to set up the sweetest scenario ever. And then I didn't have anyone to talk about it with. So it's been, and then I dreamt about it. Mm. Actually, I dreamt about having conversations about it. There is a lot to process in this film, largely because, I'm interested in your guys of this too. Him basing something, we've seen him do something before with Inglourious Basterds where mm-hmm. he did like the historical tweak, a fictional resetting in a scenario that
we should probably say right now, we're going to spoil the shit.
There's no talking about this without spoiling it.
Like, if you don't want to know, if you haven't seen it yet.
Fuck you, Sony.
Save this episode for later, because there's no way to talk about it without getting into the thing, the weeds.
And so, you're sort of three main characters. You have Leonardo DiCaprio, you have his stunt double, Brad Pitt, and then you have Margot Robbie sort of as the female lead. And it's interwoven and whatever. It was very tricky to watch this as someone who's a film lover, because I know that so much of what he's doing was kind of as a nod to that. But it also meant that historically, like, I watched it with my knowledge of every single time they showed the women at the Spawn Ranch, like mm-hmm. the Manson girls. I was like, oh man, you really set it up like that place was just a matriarchy.
Yeah.
And these women are just like, and not to deny the agency of female characters. And this is, of course, the smallest part. I'm not even talking about the three main characters I just discussed. But that colored my whole reading of the film with how he treated those women as if I, as a viewer in 2019, wasn't privy to the knowledge that these were like mostly runaways who were basically being sexually abused and fed mushrooms and acid and proselytized to by an insane megalomaniac. And so to, and then, you know, with the decisions they make later, like to have none of that put into place when you're giving this historical setting meant that it was really hard for me to look at the, like, oh, Rick Dalton and his stunt double. Yeah. Oh, and also Sharon Tate. Because I was just thinking, like, wait, why did you pick this time and place and not build in that kind of reality?
Yeah. Kay Austin Collins from Vanity Fair had a really great article on this that I think that people should look at. It's really, really thoughtful in terms of, you know, him dissecting what he thinks Quentin Tarantino was trying to do and then what he inadvertently did.
Sure.
And what ended up happening was, you know, he was kind of, you know, there's like this elegy for this time gone by, like, we should miss this. And then inadvertently he's making the case for why it shouldn't exist anymore. And that's something that I kind of latched onto when I was, you know, watching it. And he may have had a little bit of that in his head too, where like maybe that time gone by shouldn't exist anymore too. But
see,
yeah,
I came away with this notion that, like, oh, here's a movie about, this is a middle-aged filmmaker making a movie about middle-aged men who are reaching a certain point of obsolescence, which one might argue that Tarantino is as well.
Mm-hmm. Self-induced.
Well, that, but like, I mean, there was some critic who pointed out how, like, you know, this is a guy whose big claim to fame when he started out, you know, 25 or so years ago, or plus years ago, was, you know, oh, he was a video store clerk, and, you know, now he's an auteur, and it's like, tell the kids today what a video store clerk is, you know. So anyway, so the idea that this is a movie about, like, aging men, you know, finding themselves useless in an industry town.
Mm-hmm.
And then the end of the movie suggests, but they saved the 60s. Aren't they great?
Yeah.
You know, and it's sort of like, what are we, why is this suddenly this thing about how, like, why do they get to save the day in a way that didn't happen just so you can feel better about liking old character actors?
How do you guys, did you like the Inglourious Basterds revisionist history at all? Yes, no.
Yes.
Because I liked it.
Yes.
I kind of rolled my eyes and went with it, you know, because Hitler at this point is, he's an
archetype.
It's an archetype, exactly. Yeah. He's become like a metaphor at this point. Yeah. I mean, yes, he was a person, he was a terrible person who did terrible things, but so much time has passed and he has been so examined by art since 1945 that, you know, you can almost do anything with him, you know.
Yeah. My lens to this was very different, and like I also had lots of discussions about this, and then it kind of like the way I look at, like, you know, for me personally, any of these like old Hollywood movies is always, as someone who also is an actor and writer, is like, oh man, this is you. I'm watching a world in which I wouldn't have a career. Mm-hmm. And so it always comes to me for the same, with the same energy as like kids playing like cops and robbers, where it's like it's a little detached for me. And this is this to me was Quentin Tarantino's playground. And then more discussions, which when we really get into that last final action sequence, more so says this, which was the idea that was that we kind of landed on when I was talking to it with my friends, is that Quentin Tarantino in that action sequence at the end was trying to do, like, this is what we wish we could have done to those people who took Sharon Tate away from us. And it just, and that kind of made everything make a little more sense to me. But also, like, I think one of the things, and I'm sure we're going to spend the most time on this, that cannot be stepped over, which, you know, if you saw on Twitter, I was like, oh, I like the movie, but like every criticism is valid. I think one thing is like the violence towards the women in the last action sequence is so much more intense than the one male there.
Mm-hmm.
And like it's so glaringly obvious, and some people may argue it's like, oh, he got mauled by a dog. It's like, yeah, but like it was like cutaway shots, it was this like
the armed male,
yeah, yes, yeah. It like took me, like it like kind of shook me out of it. And I think the one thing that was funny was like the flamethrower bit, because it's ridiculous that he has a flamethrower, but then you still have that like after laughter of being like, yeah, but like this is just some like woman being crispified. Like, I feel two ways of it, of just like, yeah, like I had a good time, but I also didn't.
Well, I resented the final act above and beyond me talking about having, you know, emotional or philosophical worry about how these women were portrayed and then treated. I would have greatly welcomed the sort of absurd violence of it, because I've enjoyed that in other films of his, because I found I was so bored by Rick Dalton. I'm like, I don't care about this guy. Like, I thought Leonardo DiCaprio did a fine performance with him, but it's not a lot in me to summon up sympathy for some man in his 40s who's been making Hollywood money for 2 decades and is worried about, I don't care about a single, like, all of the scenes of him shooting the other Western and blah. It's like, oh my God, I checked my phone. I was like, this middle hour is
that was the part that I liked, because I didn't like the other stuff.
At least I liked the Julia Butters
scene. Performance was funny.
The girl, is that the young girl?
Yes. Yeah.
She was wonderful, but like,
but it Trudy was also, Fraser is her name, I think.
Julia Butters is the actress who plays her.
Yeah, and then her character is Trudy Fraser, but she doesn't go by
Trudy. The character she plays is Maribel.
Just to I really did like I'm going to keep trying to coin this, the Leo Dio performance going on in this. Mostly because, like, this is, my friend described it as, like, it looks like he has his Oscar and now he's trying to do fun stuff. And I was like, I want to see comedy Leo Dio. Like, this was, the whole scene where he like fucks up his line and he's like yelling at him. I love that. I really love Brad Pitt in this. I mean, we can talk about the Bruce Lee thing. I mean, I that's an interesting thing to unpack. But like the same thing that's gonna like kind of mar like my strength of my opinion in the Bruce Lee thing is kind of marring just my whole thing, because I wasn't fully up on the Manson murders. Like, you know,
Did you go to Wikipedia afterwards and go, oh, no.
Well, someone, we were having the conversation, and then because my interpretation of the ending, because this is how much little I knew of the Manson murders, was I thought this was a botched attempt that would lead to her eventual death. So this was like them trying to do it, and then later it still happens. Mm. So when someone's like, no, those are the ones who did it, and like this is a world in which like it never happened. And I was like, oh, okay. So, you know, I feel like it's the same thing with the Bruce Lee stuff, because you have like a camp of people who are like, I'm a Bruce Lee fan and I heard he was arrogant. I'm a Bruce Lee fan. And I was kind of riding with that for a minute. But then I was like, Then it kind of hit me. I thought on it, because at first I was like, yeah, I heard he was arrogant. But then I'm like, wait, Bruce Lee was a person of color in the like 60s, 70s who was successful. Yeah, no, look at Cam Newton. Like, he can't even like make it to the Super Bowl without people saying that he's cocky, because people of color are supposed to thank every white person, no matter how little power they hold over your career, for your success. So that kind of switched it. But like,
and not to mention the idea of like, as if the ending weren't enough of a white guy fantasy.
Yeah, yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, and there is, I mean, concede that the flashbacks for Cliff Booth are his POV.
Yeah, sure.
And so we should say that, but it's not clear in the movie, and that's fine. I'm okay with things not being clear. Yeah. It's just that it's so much through the point of view of white guys that is, again, my point of just like, he's actually making the case that these guys should not be in Hollywood at all.
I've been hearing that excuse. Oh, no, come on. It's his flashback. It doesn't mean it really happened. But you know what? Like, Zoe Bell is very accurately telling him to fuck off in his own flashback. Yeah. And in the course of this movie, you know, like as Bruce Lee's daughters pointed out, like, you know, Steve McQueen isn't treated like an asshole in this film. You know, Michelle Phillips and all these other real people who are in the movie.
Or the pedophile.
Too. But you know what? But that also raises the thing. And it was kind of like yesterday, where it was sort of like, could we like spend 5 minutes into the world you've created here and what that looks like? Because Sharon Tate not dying and the Mansons being foiled does open a whole new you know, that's the night that Joan Didion said killed the 60s, yeah. You know? And so if
I mean, Altamont's still going to happen, probably.
Of course, yeah. But... Well, somebody said there'd be a sequel where they go fix that, too.
Yeah,
but,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
But, you know, if Sharon Tate lives and has Roman Polanski's baby, does he get into that hot tub?
Is that going to be sequel to Yesterday?
I would like to know, but the movie, of course, ends and we'll never know.
Yeah.
But there is a whole domino effect of things happening there from this historical event. I mean, like Hitler dying in Inglourious Basterds, Hitler died anyway.
Yeah.
This is just a question of who did it and where and how. But Sharon Tate not dying like makes an impact on the culture.
Can we talk about two of the female characters who are some standouts since we covered the dud?
Yeah.
Because I think that Margaret Qualley does a really lovely job.
Oh,
yeah. And I also think that the young actress that we had already brought up.
Julia Butters. Yeah.
She's fantastic. She delivers
Housewives. She's hilarious.
She delivers one of the funniest lines of the film. And I'm not going to say it because it's just an end scene with Leo DiCaprio.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, Leo
Dio.
I believe we call him Leo Dio.
Leo Dio. It is so sweet and so funny. And she's
That's a good point to bring up. Those performances were so phenomenal, and it was like really kind of refreshing those moments to be like, okay, you know, there's some fun here to be had before the trauma ending that we get.
The exchange that Margaret Qualley kept having with Brad Pitt was also
Pussycat.
That Pussycat kept having, but she saw him like a few different times and they were recognizing each other. It felt so organic and so, to me, it was like the truest thing in it was me believing that this guy and girl would have like had this like, hey, I know you. And also, because I just saw her in Fosse
Verdon. Yeah, as Anne Rankin.
And she was good in that, but she wasn't given much to do and she was sort of, every single scene was her being like, oh, so my job's to take care of him. And so seeing her be like, oh, she was very flexible.
No, she's
in this.
Amazing. She was in Novitiate, which I haven't seen, but I hear is really good. And she was on The Leftovers.
Was Miss Golden Globes like 2 or 3 years ago.
She is also Andie MacDowell's daughter.
Exactly.
She got feet.
Oh, Jesus, the feet.
Yeah.
But I want to say, to this movie's credit, I loved soaking in the craft of it all. I loved looking at everything I was looking at for the most part, as far as like scenic design and costumes and the way Robert Richardson shoots it and the way the sun is and all that stuff. The song choices, all that kind of pop culture.
Ramblin' Man was on the soundtrack.
Yeah.
I fucking love Bob Seger, Ramblin' Man. Like,
all the movie and TV nerd shit that Tarantino and I have in common, the way he loves, like, I'm sure how much he must have enjoyed what it was like to recreate an old TV spot for a Western show.
Yes.
To do an old cigarette commercial.
Leo Dio in The Great Escape.
For instance, you know, just all of that stuff. Like, the fact that Margot Robbie is watching actual Sharon Tate in The Wrecking Crew in that, like, all of that stuff. Loved it. Would wear VR goggles and just walk around that Los Angeles all day. But
you want to make Los Angeles great again?
Yeah,
just make it smoggy again.
Yeah. Or no, it'd be Mala, whatever.
Yeah.
I put too much thought into it already. So, for our final review of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, would you screen it, stream it, or skip it?
I will say screen it, just because, for what I was saying, like I loved the experience of experiencing it, but the stuff that bugged me is really, really bugged me.
I do think screen it. I think this is the kind of film seen better, bigger.
Yes.
Seen better, bigger. I don't know if those words worked, but
bitter,
yeah.
Better, butter burgers.
Better, butter. And who shot who in the what now? That, yes. So screen it for if you're going to see it. I did get a little yawny in the middle, but, you know, life. I get yawny in the middle of all sorts of things.
I would say screen it for the fact that it is a very long movie and that you are allowed to find the movies that you like out of it. And then you can kind of throw away the rest, which is the way that I kind of like watching long movies. So I'm like, I enjoyed this part and I construct it in my head.
I liked all the fake Italian movies that he was in as well.
Yes, those are great.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I'm also going to be screen it with the disclaimer that just straight up, if you are sensitive to violence towards women and violence in general, that last act might fuck you all the way up. You know, I will say it woke me up because I was getting a little drowsy. I was like, because the only one I could see was the 10:20 at LA Live. And it was like, oh, shit. Okay. This is where we're at. But I will say, if you are going to screen it, to go to the extra challenge and try and see it at the Vista or the Los Feliz 3 to get an old Hollywood movie.
Or the New Beverly.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Yeah.
You might see Quentin there. And you can, like, very own theater.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That makes a cameo in this film.
Yeah.
The porn.
Yes,
the porn house.
Premiere.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But yeah, that's how I feel. I did not. I probably am going to see it again just to see it in that L.A. thing, because I'm L.A. native, big L.A. stan, come from my city, and I will rip you apart every time without discretion. Don't try it. It gets real out here. If you're a Clippers fan, you're not really from L.A. Also remember that.
He's still
you're
a
scumbag.
He's still
a
L.A. riffing.
This show is going to be 10 hours long.
We will be right back after we hear from another show from Max Von.
Genre film fans, hear me. I know you're out there. Do not be ashamed of your love for gore, action, sci-fi, or fantasy. It's time to come out of the shadows, because on Switchblade Sisters, we celebrate our love for genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Each week, I have a conversation with a different female filmmaker about their fave genre film, and we cover film craft, getting projects off the ground, working with actors, and our general love for genre movies. I've had so many great guests, like Heather Graham.
In the past, it's like so many films are made by men that the female point of view is not always respected, which is why all these stories haven't come out till now.
Jennifer's Body director, Karin Kusama.
I think there's a lot more fantasy and a lot more expectation projected onto a woman director.
Comedian and actor, Kate Berlant.
I mean, it sounds so cheesy to talk about it in yourself, like, you just keep going. You're, you know, I'm just a vessel. Like, I just do it. You know, I don't think, but, like, that is what it is.
And many others. So check out Switchblade Sisters every Thursday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Who Shot You? I'm your host, Ify Whiteyway, and in the studio with me are
Alonzo Duraldi,
Drea Clark,
April Wolf.
All right, as I said earlier, we have a mystery guest calling in the show. Well, we have her on the line to say goodbye to April and introducing staff writer for Slate and old friend Ingu Kang. Hello, Ingu.
Woo, woo, woo.
Hello.
Yes, thank you. Not as good as Ricky's air horns, but I will accept
it.
Yay.
Ingu, I want you to know that you're written into this as a call from a friend, parentheses, nemesis.
April is not my nemesis at all. She is my sister in being the fuck over it. And I am happy to embrace her always.
I love that.
We always tend to have the same opinions when we're texting each other. It's like, oh, wow, we thought the same thing.
That's
what does that
like
say
a...
about me?
I think the opinion is usually, I'm sad. I'm sad, too. And also, why did you send me this depressing as fuck news story?
Ingu, so we just talked about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Have you heard of this motion picture?
Who directed it again?
I didn't catch the name of the
Some
director.
Some guy ends in a vowel.
I don't understand why the Manson family is in this movie, because it's not really about them. It's about these, like, two guys who are like, oh, hey, I found my dick. Oh, cool, I found my dick, too. And so I don't understand why they're in the movie, like, at least in Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained.
Yeah.
The main characters were actually victimized by, like, the real-life villains. But here, they are not. And so it just seems like a really weird reason to, like, put them in. I had a long discussion about this movie with Dana Stevens and Matt Dessam over at Slate in the Slate spoiler special. Go check it out. And a couple people got mad at me, I guess, because I said I wish the Mansonites, especially the women, had been more... I wish they had been more humanized, because I think a lot of them were basically, like, teenagers who are runaways and who are like drugged for years and years.
You're literally saying what I said a few weeks ago. I'm with you.
But there is a lot of blowback to anyone saying that the Manson murderers were human beings who deserved any kind of kind treatment because they did horrific things.
Well, it's not like they shot up a church filled with black people, so there's no reason to humanize them.
Oh, iffy.
They did try to start a race war.
There is a book that says that was not the case that just came out.
Oh, that's right. I haven't read it yet.
Then it was an after the fact excuse.
It's like it was an after the fact excuse because it was actually there were other things going on, and so then they started.
Oh, I did hear about this.
So the whole helter skelter, whatever, any of that kind of shit was actually.
It was,
and
then it was more tied to J.C. Brings drug dealing.
Yeah.
I also want to recommend for something that treats a member of the Manson family as a human being, the essay that John Waters writes about Leslie Van Houten in his book Role Models is a beautiful piece of journalism and really kind of captures her regret and her, rehabilitation, and yet the system's refusal to ever give her parole because of the surviving family members and their blanket refusal to, let any of these people move past this.
Yeah, so Ingu, the next time someone gives you shit, definitely say exactly what Alonzo just said.
Or tell them, turn on, Netflix when there's movies about Ted Bundy or all these other male serial killers who we get to look at and see what's really going on. And it seems weird that now these young women, now's the time that we don't give them any humanization. It's almost like it's because they're gender or something like that. But that'd be crazy. We're in a post-racist, post-sexist society here.
Again, Charlie Says it's streaming.
Charlie Says is great.
Ingu, is there any advice you'd like to give April as she sets out into the sunset, leaving us behind?
The door slams her in the ass.
Well, since we're burying her, I'm going to say I'm really happy and looking forward to her movie, which you guys have probably talked about at length. So I guess I will just see you on the internet, and whoever doesn't, which is, I guess, 99% of the people who listen to this podcast, I'm sorry. I'm keeping her all to myself.
I'm always suspect when Ingu says she's happy.
No, you have to take it.
And when she says she's keeping you to herself, I think there's a secret room involved.
Yeah, she just got a house, I think, so.
Oh, I think the other thing that both Drea and I can provide as life advice is use more snail cream.
Yes.
It is literally like the excretions of the snail.
You can get both the snail excretions and a mucus snail form. Yeah, it's so good for the skin.
And
vegetarians love
it. If you are a horror person, I don't understand how this is not constantly on your face.
Yeah.
How does it smell?
It smells delicious.
It smells like nothing.
Like escargot.
It smells like amazing moisturized skin.
Yeah, I remember my dad. I've snuck snails into his soup for a long time. I just thought it was chewy chicken. And my stepmom one time was like, oh, your dad's been giving you snails. I was like, Dad, have you been giving me snails? He's like, yes, there's snails in the soup. I was like, okay. And there was a can he'd get from this Nigerian food market to African food market, and it just said escargot.
And you know what? Iffy's skin looks amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's my secret.
He's 80 years old.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye, Ingu.
Bye, Ingu. Bye, Ingu.
Now it's time for our staff picks. It could be any movie in theaters, streaming, what have you. Drea, why don't you start?
Why, thank you. I love starting. So I have a film that's currently on Netflix called American Honey, and I'm recommending it because I love it, and it's such a great immersive film and very lyrical, and it's good. It feels like summer if your summer involves hanging out in vans with very dirty street kids. And it's the reason I'm bringing it up now is the director of it, Andrea Arnold, directed this past season of Big Little Lies, and then it came out the last couple of weeks that there were all these shenanigans behind the scenes and that she kind of lost control and that they sent the edit back to Jean-Marc Vallée. Anyway, I think that she deserves her time in the sun. And yeah, you should check out that film. It has some really interesting performances from Shia LaBeouf and a discovery in Sasha Lane. And then also, is it Riley Keough?
Keough,
who someone said to me, I can't, you know that Quentin Tarantino wanted Riley Keough for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, because that girl, it kind of shocks me she wasn't in the lineup. So I think that was the other reason it was in my head. Mm. Yeah, American Honey.
You'll feel like you're never getting out of that van.
I loved it. There's so much trap music.
Ever. I'm sold.
Mine's a book, actually. I think this is the perfect companion to go with your Criterion Godzilla box, which, of course, you're all going to buy. It's a book called Ishiro Honda, A Life in Film from Godzilla to Kurosawa, by Steve Reifel and Ed Godzizewski. And it is the definitive biography of Ishiro Honda, who is this fascinating figure in Japanese cinema. He is the guy behind most of the best of the early period of Godzilla. And then, yeah, just like went to work on some Kurosawa movies. And like, I think he was worked on Dreams and some of the other kind of later Kurosawa titles. And it's just, you know, tons of interviews. And if you are interested in monster movies or Japanese cinema in general, this is good stuff.
Oh, mine is a movie.
good for you. How nice.
It's The Nightingale, which comes out in New York and L.A. The day that this episode hits. And then for the rest of you folks, you're going to have to wait just a little bit longer, but it will open wide. And then, you know, a few months down the line, won't be streaming, I'm sure. But The Nightingale from director of Babadook, Jennifer Kent, who is our guest on Switchblade Sisters this week as well, talking about The Innocents. But this movie, The Nightingale.
What a coincidence.
I know, weird. But I'm really taken by her directing, her style, the... I fucking hate this word when you describe things. Unflinching way that she approaches really terrible, terrible things. Like, I'm not one who enjoys watching rape scenes, for instance, and not one who enjoys watching, like, too much murder, too much, like, blunt murder. And yet at the same time, something about the way that she portrays these in regard to colonial Australia, where a woman teams up with an Aboriginal man and I think an Aboriginal woman and some other folks to essentially kind of track down these people who hurt them. And it's one of the few revenge films that makes you contemplate if revenge is good and if it's good for the psyche, if it's good for the soul, if it's good for anything. And that's something, the kind of thinking that I really appreciate in movies. But it's also just so beautiful. But I see it in the theater because the sound design is fucking crazy. It's a beautiful film. Think about what she did with The Babadook, right?
Mm.
And then do a colonial period piece where you're using horror techniques on real stories. And it is mind-bending. It is such a fascinating movie, and it's going to be super polarizing, and that's something I'm really excited to talk about.
Ooh. Well, you know, I just remembered, because I wanted to have this be my staff pick since we announced the Criterion Collection, but I think I did it earlier, which was Shin Godzilla. I love the movie.
Oh,
I can't talk about it enough. But if you did see it from the last time I suggested it, I'll say watch the original American Godzilla, just so you can hear P. Diddy sing that Walk With Me song. It's very good. Also,
Leave This House.
Also, honestly, one of my favorite designs of Godzilla, that thick neck with that dino head. which is what made the movie even more disappointing, because I liked the look. And then we got a thick Godzilla in Shin Godzilla. So there's two thick Godzillas I'm suggesting for you, whichever one. You want thick legs, go Shin. You want a thick neck, go with the original American Godzilla. Keep it thick. And now's the time where we have to say goodbye to April.
The long goodbye.
Oh, yeah. It's a long goodbye.
See you guys.
Hold on.
Lady, you know, we started this thing with that guy. What's his
name? Ricky.
Ricky
Carmona, him. And so, you know, we'll it's been an ongoingly different experience during your during your hiatus, and now you're gone for good, and that's going to suck. But, you know, it's very exciting that we're still doing this show, and I love doing it with Dre and Iffy, and they are bringing all sorts of new zazz to the table. And you are like a fucking working screenwriter in Los Angeles.
Yeah, but I'm going to have to cut off all of our friendships so you can actually review my movies now.
Yeah, too late.
I'm not a critic. You can still be friends with me.
That's right.
You'll be not returning my calls for naught.
Yeah.
I've wrote a few words.
Oh Jesus!
Because you know we've had so many good times. So how do I say goodbye to what we had? The good times that made us laugh outweighed the bad. I thought we'd get to see forever, but forever has blown away. Yes. It's so hard to say goodbye to yesterday. I don't know where this road is going to lead to. All I know is where we've been and what we've been through. If it gets me tomorrow, I hope it's worth all the pain. It's so hard to say goodbye to yesterday. And I'll take with me the memories to be my sunshine after the rain. It's so hard to say goodbye to yesterday. It's a poem I wrote for you.
He wrote that.
Wow. Oh my God.
Yeah.
He wrote it in 4-part harmony.
Yeah. But yeah. From my heart. Wow. To yours.
That was incredible. I don't have a poem, but
is it entitled Motown Philly?
Motown Philly back again. Yes. But I'm definitely going to go put on my oversized 3-piece suit.
Ooh.
And they have matching ones. So, I love April Wolf, and it's been very exciting because I'm such a fan of yours, and you have intimidated me since the day I met you, and it is an honor to say that we're actual friends, and you still intimidate me a lot, which is a really nice and specific shelf that you're on. Ingu also terrifies me, so it's like a very good place to be. But yes, I'm so excited for you, and I can't wait to listen and watch everything you do.
Oh, I'm going to miss you guys so much. Iffy the most, though.
Yes.
We all
have favorites.
Right. Sometimes it snows in April. Sometimes I feel so bad.
I would have jumped in, but he picked a real Alonzo key.
Sometimes I wish that life were never ending. And all good things they say never last.
Oh my God. How fucking appropriate that is.
That was nice. That was nice.
Alonzo's eyes were closed, so you know he was singing.
I feel a little faint now.
But now it's time for the 5-star reviews. If you leave us a 5-star review, we'll read it on the air. And since we don't have any new 5-star reviews, producer Casey was forced to make one up. The Who Shot You podcast is the highest form of art ever achieved throughout the existence of mankind. How can one person find value in Van Gogh's Starry Night or Claude Debussy's Clair de Lune or even a sunset, knowing that Who Shot You exists? 5 stars.
That seems like a reasonable review.
Yeah, this is the template, people. Yeah, take that as your starting point.
Yeah, take that and run with it. Next week, Dre and I will not be here, but Alonzo will be holding down the fort with Jin Yamato of the LA Times and film critic William Bibiani. They will... are you serious?
I know, dude. I said the same thing.
You leave town, you miss out.
You leave town, you can't talk about Hobbs and Shaw, motherfucker.
The Fast and Furious presents Hobbs and Shaw, which everyone knows is unironically my favorite film franchise. Yes.
Me too.
Even more than the MCU, I am all about the FFCU.
Well, see you at the finale of the Furious.
Jen Yamato will definitely be talking about Justice for Han, which is for Crusade.
Oh, man, that's... Yeah.
And Bibbs has...
sure Bibbs has something fun.
Oh, he was already telling me about how he talked to the actor who played Han and found out that Better Luck Tomorrow is considered canonical. So we're going to get deep.
All right.
Okay, well, shit. Please call into the Who Shot line, I guess. We got a ton of calls last week. Thank you to everyone who called in. We even got a correction from Jennifer in San Francisco. We had said during our conversation about the farewell that Awkwafina spoke Cantonese. Oh, that was me. But in fact, she is speaking Mandarin. So thank you, Jennifer, for the correction. Again, the number for the Who Shot line is WSY-803-1664. That was me. But I wanted to say something other than Chinese, and I still, I should have just fucked it up in a general sense.
You had a 50-50.
Yeah. And I just, woof. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at WhoShotYaPod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYaPodcast or send us an email at WhoShotYa@MaximumFun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
100!
100!
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.